The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I'm Kurt Benrud with the North Carolina Reading Service. Welcome to Sci-Fi. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be reading to you from Daily Sci-Fi.
My name is Steve Lord, and I'll be reading the story Tommy by H.G. Parry. The police had been again in the night. Tommy's bedroom was right near the stairwell, so he could always hear their footsteps thundering up before the sound of glass smashing and the screams. In the morning, he went into the corridor to see which door it had been. There were always glass shards crunched into the linoleum afterwards, so he wore his slippers. "The neighbors from flat 705 have gone," he informed his mother as he came back. "The Wallaces." "Nobody ever lived in flat 705," his mother said. She was frying ham, and her face was pink. "It's always been empty. We never had neighbors there." Tommy sighed. "Well, they're gone," he said, and pulled himself up on his seat to wait for breakfast. When his plate came, there was less ham than there had been this time last year, and the butter on his toast was scraped very thin. His mother had no ham at all. Tommy went to Lilith's house for lunch. Lilith had pretty blonde curls and wore dresses, but she was his age and knew how to play all the games that other kids didn't understand. She was his only friend, and sometimes he thought he loved her, even though her curls were so pretty. Her mother gave them water and sandwiches, and then they went to Lilith's room and sat on the yellow woolen blanket that covered her bed. Tommy loved the blanket. It was the only wool he had ever seen. "Did you hear the police come last night for the Wallaces?" Lilith asked. Tommy plucked at the blanket. "Mum says there are no Wallaces," he said. "That's silly," Lilith said, not unkindly. "I remember them. They had a baby, and once they asked if I would like to hold it. I didn't want to, though." "No way," Tommy agreed, making a face. "It smelled." "Mum and Dad are going to see about getting them back," Lilith said. "Back from where?" Tommy asked. "I don't know," Lilith said. "Where they are." "That's silly," Tommy said. "If there never were any Wallaces, they can't come back." When he was younger, Tommy would say good night to the people who had no longer ever existed. He thought dimly that if he kept their names in the world, they would still be there too. His mother came in one night when he was in the middle of telling Mr. Schreiber to sleep well. "Mr. Schreiber's not here, Tommy," she said. "He was never here." "He was," Tommy said. "He used to play the violin." His mother sighed. "When we lose people, Tommy," she said, "it's better to pretend that we never had them at all." "Why?" "It's just better, that's all." "Does that go for things, too?" "Yes, it does." "Like when the teacher took away my storybook?" "Yes." "And when there was no ice cream anymore, or cake, or milk?" "Yes." "And when it goes for everything, Tommy," she said. "It never does to dwell on what we can no longer have, if we want to survive." "Do we want to survive?" "I want you to survive," she said, "more than anything else in the world." The police came for Lilith's family when Tommy was lying in bed. He heard the smash, and he thought he heard her scream, although he had never heard her scream before, so he could not be sure. The next day he went to look in the corridor to make sure the broken glass did lead to her flat and not one of the others. He went in and checked the rooms in case they had left her behind. The chairs were kicked over and her yellow blanket was on the floor. He felt like crying then, but he didn't. There had never been a Lilith. He had never had a friend. Maybe that was why he was crying. One night, Tommy woke to noises that were not in the stairwell, and not the police. They were quiet noises, scufflings and whispers, and he could see light passing under his door. For a second he pulled the covers over his head. Then he threw them off and got to his feet. As he got closer, the voices grew clearer. One was his mother's, the other a man's. "Dissenters, they say," the strange voice was saying. "But I'll tell you what, Lucy, the majority of them have no more dissent in them than a block of wood. It's the food thing. The more dissenters they get, the less mouths to feed, the further we are from starvation. And right now..."
"This will hurt,"
Tommy's mother interrupted. A second later there was a strangled noise, like a cry trying not to be heard. Tommy's heart was pounding, and he wanted to go back to bed and hide. But his mother was there, so he put out his hand and opened the door. The lamp was lit, pooling soft yellow light over the couch. On the couch was a man Tommy had never seen before, stretched out with his leg resting on a pile of towels. There was a towel wrapped around his knee, too, as though he were hurt, but the rest of him looked lithe and fit. He was old, but not very old, and his face had stubble across it, and interested blue eyes peering out of it. They fell on Tommy. "Hello," the man said softly. "Who's this?" Tommy's mother turned, and her eyes widened.
"Tommy," she whispered. She sounded angry. "What are you doing up?"
"I heard noises," he said. He blinked at the man in the lamplight. He looked very pale, more pale than anyone Tommy had ever seen. And there was a thin sheen of sweat shining his brow. "I wanted to see what it was."
"And if it had been the police?" his mother demanded, still whispering.
"I know what the police sound like," Tommy protested.
"Of course he knows," the man said. "Is this Tommy, then?"
"I don't have any other small children secreted about the place," she said tartly, then immediately shook her head.
"Oh, I'm sorry, both of you. I'm all on edge. I did want Tommy kept out of it."
"He will be loose," the man said. "I promise."
"You can't promise anything," she said, but without anger. She rubbed her brow with one hand, and a streak of something red rubbed off. It was then that Tommy noticed the tweezers in her hand, and that the towels about the man's leg were red as well.
"Tommy, this is your uncle," his mother added. "He's in trouble with the police."
"I'm at war with the police," his uncle said, "and all they stand for."
"Oh, don't make it worse," his mother sighed. "How do you do?" Tommy said politely. He hadn't known he had an uncle, but this made perfect sense to him. Until his uncle was here, he had not existed.
"Real war?"
"With real bullets," his mother said. "Tommy, please go back to bed." "We'll talk later," his uncle promised, "when I'm not dizzy and seeing two of you."
"No, Jonas," his mother said. It was the only time he heard his uncle's name. "You're going to have to be gone by the time Tommy gets up again. I love you, but I love him more than life, and I will not allow him to be in any danger."
His uncle nodded very slowly and swayed.
"I understand. Just let me rest a bit, and I'll be gone by daybreak."
"Before then," his mother warned, but more softly. She turned to Tommy. "Please, go to bed, my love."
"All right," Tommy nodded. "It was nice to meet you, Uncle Jonas."
"You too," his uncle said. He gave a twitch of a smile. "Remember, my lad, I was never here."
Tommy nodded. "I know how it works when people go," he said.
His uncle was gone in the morning. Some of his blood was still on the floor, and his mother was pale and frightened, but he had never had an uncle. Tommy wondered sometimes where they all went, those people who no longer were. It scared him, and he felt very cold. Perhaps that was why it was better that they never were. Then they weren't anywhere. The police came again in the night. Tommy heard them on the stairwell, then the door smashing in and the screams. It was his own door this time, and the screams were louder because they were closer. Tommy hid under the covers and clamped his hands to his ears. When he got up the next morning, there was broken glass on the carpet, and one of the chairs had turned over.
Tommy straightened it and went to get a brush for the floor. He wasn't surprised to find that his mother was gone. He knew he had never had a mother.
Hello, this is Laurie Lee reading The Rememberists by Thomas A. Mays. Ansel Matthews poured cream into his coffee and watched as entropy curled black and white to brown. He enjoyed tracking the delicate whorls of liquid as they folded in upon one another. But he would not remember this. It was too mundane an event to retain specifics. There was far too much to remember already, and even more to forget. He looked at his guest in the diner's booth and stirred his cup. My gift is one of premature credulity. You tell me how things happened, and I'll believe you. I'll share your story with my equally unquestioning brethren around the globe, and together we remember your version of history. Soon, a tipping point is reached where belief becomes reality and the deed is done. Your past is changed. She narrowed her eyes. That can't possibly be true. Representative Karen Reed was recognized by most as a practical and principled public servant, but she had sought Ansel out and sat down in his booth, not the reverse. Her protest was hollow. He shrugged. They pay you to debate. They pay me to accept. And I do all right. Prove it. Whose history have you changed? Ansel gave her a melancholy smile and sipped his coffee. Too sweet. Must have forgotten how many sugars I put in. Our services wouldn't be worth much if you could pick out the changes. We accept your reality, and eventually it becomes the reality all accept. Everyone assumes history is a fixed, true thing, but our own timelines, past, present, and future, are defined by what we believe of the past. The public believes what its most committed members believe, whether they're experts or merely the nagging voices of certainty. I'll commit to whatever story you tell me. Reed fidgeted in her seat, as if confirming its solidity. But what about evidence to the contrary, or eyewitnesses? Won't those screw up your version of history? He nodded and set his cup back down on its saucer. I only put in one sugar, that's all. If we do our work right, physical evidence becomes transparent fabrication. Witnesses doubt their own recollection until they accept the zeitgeist. Whatever came before might even fade away completely. Countering a widely accepted or strongly implanted reality requires more effort on our part, more intrusion into public perception, but in the end, you yourself will doubt what you used to think was the undeniable truth. Just look at the moon landings. The representative peeked an eyebrow at him. Are you implying those actually were faked? Ansel frowned and shook his head. No, just the opposite. Conspiracy theories like that only pop up as a bleed-over from much larger manipulations. The moon job was, unfortunately, in my opinion, a very successful modification. When you think of Apollo, you think of a program with six successful landings that fizzled due to a jaded public and fickle politics. If I talk about Apollo 18, or mention Hephaestus, or the Lebedev obelisk, you have no idea what I'm referring to. He slumped disappointed and stirred his coffee. Reed leaned forward, eyes wide. They found something on the moon, and you people covered it up? What about other conspiracy theories, like 9/11, or the Kennedy assassination? Ansel shrugged. Those aren't germane. Karen, you can look at this mundanely, that we're just a viral marketing form of propaganda, or you can see it as I do, that objective reality is the gestalt of all subjective realities, that this is a quantum holographic universe defined by perception and belief, subject to manipulation. He smiled and continued, So, what story do you want remembered differently? She seemed to consider her options and then sighed. I'm running for national office, but there's this possible thing in my past that could ruin. Don't tell me what others want remembered. Tell me what reality should be. Reed closed her eyes. Edward was one of my staffers when I first started out. He might insinuate that we did things together in the office. Things that might have involved campaign finances and drugs and infidelities. But you didn't? Her cheeks flushed. Let's say no. Let's say his evidence is only fabricated. Help me. He's trying to get revenge on me for firing him. But I don't deserve that. I deserve to win. Ansel's gaze bore into her, skewering her soul. Is that what truly happened? She paused before giving him a slight nod. He smiled. Then I believe you. Email me some info on Edward, a few photos and details, anything you can think of to flesh it out, and you can consider it a done deal. Karen Reed stood without preamble, as if anxious to be gone. She reached into her purse and pulled out a fat envelope stuffed with bills. Your payment, Mr. Matthews. He took it and nodded. Ah, yes, but there's one other requirement. What? Ansel sighed, apologetic. I need you to remember something for me. Remember it and believe it. She appeared cautious. Okay, what is it? Just this. There, at the last, Anna believed me, believed that I loved her. And that was enough. She didn't pull the trigger. She simply lived. Will you remember that for me, please? Reed nodded. I will. I'll remember. She walked out of the diner, only pausing once to look back at him before exiting. Ansel picked up his coffee again. It had cooled some, but it tasted fine, with but a hint of sweetness to cut the natural bitterness and acidity. Satisfied, he put down the cup and pulled out his phone. He dialed the first contact and waited for Anna to pick up. It sounded a three-tone alarm, warning that he had dialed a number that had been disconnected. But that was all right. It would not always be disconnected, not if enough people remembered the way it should have been.
I'm Kurt Benrud. This is Marking Time by Stephanie Burgess. This bead marks the moment you told Tom Merchant, high on your first ever vodka shots and the teeth-jittering adrenaline of being out, even as just part of a group, with Tom Merchant, the most brilliant, amazing guy you'd ever met, that you couldn't care less about your practical engineering major, that thing your parents were both so proud of. No, you declared, slamming down your fourth shot, you were going to be an artist instead. Tom looked at you with real interest in his eye for the first time ever. And you changed your major the next day, hungover and scared, but bone-deep determined to follow through and be the girl who could impress him. Still, your hands shook as you signed the forms, and you couldn't bring yourself to tell your parents for over 4 months. By then, you and Tom had unofficially moved in together, you and him jamming all your clothes and books together into your single dorm room. And that's the next bead on your necklace. You were shaking again when you hung up from the phone call with your parents that night, the one where you admitted everything. But he hugged you, and he told you you were amazingly brave for standing up against fascist authority. Who cared what they thought after that? You didn't go home for Christmas that year, for the first time ever. Instead, you and Tom got a ride from one of his friends to Chicago. You curled up in a blanket on their floor on Christmas Eve while Tom sat up smoking pot and debating politics for hours. So smart and articulate and vivid and funny, you could barely believe you really got to be there watching him up close. You told yourself you'd never been so happy in your life. The next bead marks graduation. Your parents were there, in the background at least, smiling tightly and watching you with big, worried eyes while you held yourself rigid, waiting, just waiting to leap to Tom's defense the moment they made a single wrong move. They never understood how special he was. And he was right. He really was. They always tried to ruin everything. but they didn't say a word, not even when you moved with Tom 2 days later, following him across the country to his dream grad school and declining all three of the MFA programs you'd gotten into back east. You picked up a secretarial job instead in his department, and he promised he'd absolutely make the same sacrifices for you too one day. After all, that was what couples did when they were really, truly committed. When your mother did try, just once, to ask you whether it was worth it, whether you and Tom couldn't live apart for just 1 or 2 years while you took your own degree, you shut her down with a death glare before she could even finish her question. You wouldn't answer her phone calls for the next 2 weeks, following Tom's advice. He said you should really be separating from your parents by now anyway. They certainly couldn't be a part of any true and honest life together, not when they were so controlling and judgmental about your relationship. How could she even think to ask a question like that? You and Tom both knew love was more important than anything. Bead after bead sits in the pot before you now. Feel them slipping through your fingers as you slide them onto the leather cord, forming the necklace of all your moments. Knot them tight with all your pain. This is the most important art project of your life. Think of it as a final exam. Secretaries are always the recipients of gossip, aren't they? They find out about everything. You even found out about me when the others in the office whispered about the crazy woman in the farmer's market with her beads and her weird stories. It was only inevitable that you would find out about Tom. It was only unfortunate that you didn't find out in time, before you agreed to take out that second mortgage, before he had a chance to clear out your joint account. Tonight your children have gone to bed at last, leaving echoes of shouting and tears in the shadows of the darkened house. They're angry and scared and broken, just like you. Maybe one day they'll actually blame Tom for what's happened, but right now you're the only parent left, the only focus they can find for all their anger and their loss. Anyway, you were always the boring one, weren't you? The parent they rolled their eyes at and found easy to dismiss. You'd never even had any dreams of your own, as far as they could ever tell. Tonight, all of your old dreams seem a long way away, as distant as all the other lives you could have led over the years. All you have to grasp onto now in the silent kitchen of the house that you are about to lose are the beads that I gave you in the market today. The only question left to ask is, how many moments are you prepared to sacrifice? Exactly how far back will you go? The moment you held your first art show in college with Tom celebrating by your side, when you kept laughing out loud in wonder and delight? The moment you finally gave in to Tom's passionate arguments and told your parents not to call you anymore? Or the moment you found his letter on the table? The necklace is finally complete. Listen to your children's sleeping breaths upstairs, in that pause before they wake to rage and blame you once again. Your children are made of those moments, too. The phone rings and rings as you sit in the darkened kitchen, staring at the finished necklace. Finally, the answering machine clicks on. For the first time in 5 years, you hear your mother's voice, stilted with pride and reserve and fear. "Anne," she says, "I know. We heard what happened." Humiliation burns through your body like a toxin. Dread almost chokes you to imagine how they've discussed it. You pick up the necklace, shivering convulsively at the horror of that thought. "We tried to tell her," they must have said to each other. "If only she had listened." But this time, for the first time, you know exactly what to do. Just shatter those fragile, terrible beads on the hard table before you, and you'll never have to hear those words again, not even in your imagination. You'll be that fresh, bright girl so full of promise, the engineering student with all A's, the girl with everything ahead of her and pride glowing in her parents' voices as they brag about her to anyone who will listen. Not this tired, empty woman who made the wrong choices and lost it all. You take a deep breath. You lift the necklace high above the hard wooden table. And then, in a single moment, you pull it over your head. Everyone's lives are made up of moments. You wear every one of them, your mistakes and your past, as you force yourself to pick up the impossibly heavy phone and take a step into your future. Mom, your voice is scratchy when you speak. You hear your mother's breath catch in what sounds like a sob. Your fingers tighten around the phone. Mom, you whisper across the distance with your beads around your neck, I'm here. And for the first time in years, it's really true.
This is Steve Lord, and I'm reading the story 84% Compatible by Jared K. Anderson. The gap between Ted's front teeth opened onto a solar system buzzing with civilizations of light and power. Every once in a while, it would glint and draw the eye of Becky Cooley, the shy paralegal with the 84% compatibility rating from the dating website. Ted found that trying to laugh behind his hand was awkward. Trying to tilt his head down while he spoke was awkward. He'd lost dates to awkwardness and to the bushy mustache he had used to curtain his upper teeth for a few weeks in June. So Ted tried to talk with Becky head-on, and her inevitable questions followed. Questions about the twinkle between his teeth, the sense of life and hope and industry in it. Ted felt his cheeks and ears get hot, but he did his best not to sound embarrassed. He answered Becky's questions. He even did his best to answer the questions she would think of later. It's a solar system. It's been there ever since my adult teeth came in. I don't know if it's just a doorway, or if the whole system is actually there in my mouth. I don't know if it will live on after I die. I'm not sure if the people there know about me, or have ever tried to communicate. Yes, the government knows all about it. Becky went still, and Ted worried that it might have been rude of him to anticipate her future questions. The specter of awkwardness grew like an afternoon shadow. Becky didn't quite smile as she pushed her long brown hair behind her left ear and tilted her head. There, above her little gold earring, nestled in the folds of her ear, Ted could just see a bluish glow. And in that glow was somehow the force of gravity held in balance amongst the waltz of stars and planets and the countless souls that spun along with them. When Ted smiled, he smiled with the light of 300 billion stars. Becky smiled back.
We've run out of time for today's episode of Sci-Fi. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Kurt Benrood, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Sci-Fi is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.